Madam Chair, we are live recording and you may gavel in the meeting when ready.
Thank you. Good morning. The open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for March 25th, 2021 will come to order. We have some late submitted documents this morning, Mr. Vice Chair.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Morning. I have two motions, which I will combine. I move that the Commission add to the agenda draft advisory opinion 2021-01. And that the Commission determine, pursuant to 11 CFR section 2.7D, that business so requires and no earlier public announcement was possible. I further move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the Commission may consider agenda document numbers 21-15B, 21-19A, and 21-19B.
Thank you. The Vice Chair is so moved. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I will call the question. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 The motion passes 6-0. Going to move on. The first item on the agenda is advisory opinion request 2021-03, the National Republican Senatorial Committee and National Republican Congressional Committee, submitted by Jessica Johnson, Chris Winkleman, Ryan Dollar, and Aaron Clark. We're joined today by Jennifer First Johnson and Ryan Grant Clark, the Requesters Council, who are available to respond to questions from the commissioners, if there are any. Ms. Johnson and Mr. Dollar, I want to say welcome. I did say it earlier, but I want to say it on the record for you. Welcome today. And we also have from the Office of General Counsel, Heather Philmeyer and Robert Knott from OGC here to discuss the matter. So we will ask OGC to begin with the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, Commissioners. Before you in Agenda Documents 21-19-A and B are draft advisory opinions responding to a request from the National Republican Senatorial Committee and the National Republican Congressional Committee. The requesters, who are national party committees comprised of all sitting Republican members of the Senate and the House, ask whether their members may use campaign funds to pay for personal security expenses to protect themselves and their immediate family members in light of the current heightened threat environment to which they are subject because of their duties as office holders. Both drafts conclude that they may, because the costs arise due to senators' and representatives' roles as federal office holders. We did not receive any comments on the request or on the drafts. Thank you, and I would be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Knopp. I'm going to turn to my commissioners, fellow commissioners. Are there any questions for the Office of General Counsel or for our requesters?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Cooksey.
I think off the bat, it would be helpful to hear from the requesters about whether they have any views about which draft they prefer or any concerns they have with either draft.
Thank you, Commissioner Cooksey. Requesters, feel free. Mr. Dollar, Ms. Johnson, would you like to respond?
I'm sorry, can you all hear us okay?
We can now. Thank you.
Wonderful. I apologize.
Okay.
Thank you for having us today. We would love to respond. Thank you for your time for this, what we perceive to be a very important issue. When we submitted this request, we did it in line with the request that the commission dealt with in 2017-07, where the commission approved an advisory opinion request that asked for confirmation that non-structural security expenses were a proper use of campaign funds, both ordinary and necessary, and for a lawful purpose, not otherwise prohibited by statute. And at that time, in light of the current threat facing members of Congress, the commission rightfully decided unanimously, might I add, that the threats that those members face today necessitated a proactive rather than a reactive response. The commission continued to state that members are no longer able to wait until confirmation of a threatening communication before taking steps necessary to protect themselves and their families. So in light of the threat that we face today, which unfortunately has not subsided, I would argue has only increased, we thought it was incredibly important to ask that campaign funds be able to be used to hire security personnel, professional, legitimate, bona fide security personnel to protect members and their families. And I must take a moment to add that, you know, it should go without saying that, the request was for just that. It was for bona fide, professional, legitimate security personnel. We in no way object to the use of the word bona fide in draft B. However, we do think it's really important to note that the point of the request was to permit members to quickly and efficiently make arrangements to protect themselves and their families and remove any bureaucracy or hurdles in the way. Defining bona fide the way that draft B does by referencing licensing, insurance, and bonding requirements, which, by the way, differ in every state and in every jurisdiction across the country, it just creates one more hurdle. Practically speaking, if a threat were to be made in the midst of the day and a member would like to engage security personnel to sit outside their home at night so themselves and their families can sleep soundly, having to check off and tick through licensing requirements, bonding requirements that certainly aren't second nature to these members, something they know off the top of their heads, might create an additional hurdle that would only make it seem like the request for security was just too difficult to tackle. I mean, furthermore, these members travel, especially in campaign season, all across the country, sometimes making multiple stops in multiple states and jurisdictions in one day. So to require them to, you know, confirm and check out all of these licensing and bonding and insurance requirements in order for these trips to be made seems a little bit cumbersome, especially when we're talking about quite literally protecting the members and their families. So, you know, we want to be exceedingly clear that we never intended for the security personnel utilized to be anything other than legitimate, bona fide, professional security personnel. Frankly, suggesting otherwise is a little bit insulting and ridiculous. And we feel like it's playing politics with the safety and security of these members and families. So, you know, while we wholeheartedly support the first draft, we were thrilled to see it and feel like it's in line with the precedent that the commission has issued specifically with respect to advisory opinion 2017-07 that was issued unanimously. We you know, are concerned with some of the requirements set forth in draft B.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Putzi.
I guess maybe this question is best directed at OGC, if they have any insight, or maybe my fellow commissioners have any insight. I guess what we're calling draft B or revised draft A, in one of the, as the requesters indicated, one of the conditions of being a bona fide personal security personnel services licensure, I don't know in the short time we've been able to do a 50 state survey of what the occupational licensing requirements are in these states, but it seems to me that that is some vague wording that might cause some confusion if, for example, a state did not have licensure for security services, but suppose a firm had a business license. Is it clear that they would be licensed under this AO, or how would that work if we know, or maybe we're creating more confusion than we mean to?
Mr. Knopf?
I really don't know how to answer that, to be honest. I don't think it answers itself. I would have assumed that it meant licensing for the purpose of providing security, not business license, given the context. So I think that's the most logical or reasonable way to read it. I don't know if something else was intended.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please go ahead.
And maybe this is a question for the requesters who are maybe more expert in this. You know, I guess one of the other conditions that I'd like your reaction on is the exclusion of the use of the permissible use of these campaign funds for personal security services. If this is in the revised draft, if the members are otherwise are not otherwise being protected by federal law enforcement agents or Capitol Police. Of course, the Capitol Police are federal law enforcement agents, so that's a bit redundant. But, you know, how do you, to the extent that you know, How does that work in practice for members of the leadership of the House and the Senate? They, of course, have Capitol Police details that follow them, but not all members do, though they are under the protection of Capitol Police when they're on Capitol grounds. At the same time, members of leadership's families don't necessarily have Capitol Police protection. So, you know, is there a risk that this becomes administratively impossible, to take a hypothetical, if the majority leader, Senator Schumer, has a Capitol Police detail, his family lives in New York, would it be the case that they can have personal security services when he's out of town, but not when he's in town? How does this exclusion impact the administrability of the use of personal security services, in your view?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. I think that's a very valid question. And again, we are in favor of a reading of this request that would state that this is perfectly permissible under the regulation and the advisory opinions that the commission has already issued as a necessary and ordinary use of campaign funds. And I think any restrictions that are placed on top of a request for very legitimate and regular security would certainly be cumbersome and burdensome when we're quite literally talking about the safety of members and their families. I do think about the incident that happened on the baseball field that I believe precipitated the request in 2017. And there, if my memory serves, the leadership that were present at that baseball practice had security detail, but the other members did not. And I think it was widely reported and agreed that should there have, not been that leadership security, that would have been highly problematic. And should additional security have been present, that would have been very helpful in deterring the threat. And so here, I would remind the commission that, we're not dealing, unfortunately, with hypotheticals. We're dealing with real life threatening situations where members and their family in the past have been threatened and feel threatened today. And we would again, remind the commission that we're certainly in agreement and talking about very legitimate professional security. But any additional, regulations or checks that must be put on top of that request would only be cumbersome to these members who are trying to protect themselves and their families. And I agree. I think it would make it likely that they might think it's not worth doing. And I hesitate and I think that's terrifying to think what could result.
Yeah. And I would add to answer your question, Commissioner Cooksey, specifically, I don't know the answer to kind of the interplay between leadership detail and, where exactly that extends to. But I think that goes to why we like draft A so much. Because if we don't know how, that would impact leadership detail and their travel plans, we don't want the commission or, the candidates and members themselves to have to make that analysis. So.
And to be clear, the intent is not to interfere with Capitol Police. I think that's really important to state. We're in no way suggesting that they're not capable of doing their job, but we certainly think that it's important to fill in the cracks, where necessary. And in this threat environment, all the security that a member and their families believe that they need to be able to continue to do their job and live their lives, we're in favor of.
Thank you.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little bit puzzled by the last back and forth because the request itself says on page 2 in footnote 5, in certain instances, one or more federal law enforcement agencies may offer to provide security to a member or a member's family. The request would only apply in those instances where federal agents are not protecting the member or member's families, and in no way would any private personnel retained pursuant to this request interfere with the operations of federal law enforcement agencies. So that language in the revised draft comes straight out of the request, which I assume you meant what you said when you submitted it. So I assume you have no objection to our including language in the response that comes directly out of your request.
Yes, Commissioner, we wholeheartedly, and as I just said, we certainly do not intend to interfere. We do not intend for the security that is hired to interfere with Capitol Police. That's certainly not the intent. That being said, we do think, as I just discussed with the situation on the baseball field in 2017, additional security would have certainly been helpful. I'm certain that the members of Congress that have felt threatened, as has been reported publicly over the course of the past few months, I'm certain they would have found it helpful to have security at their homes, which is not something that is currently provided, to my knowledge, by Capitol Police. And so that's simply what we're asking for, in the same manner that the advisory opinion in 2017 thought it was a proper use of campaign funds to protect the actual physical structure of the home. We think it is logically, makes sense that they would consider a logical use of campaign funds and a proper use of campaign funds to protect the actual humans as well, when the Capitol Police security does not permit that use of funds.
I understand. I remember well that tragic incident on the baseball field and the commission's response to it. Mm-hmm. But as I said, the language in that you were just disputing comes directly out of the request, and it was just incorporated into the revised draft. Let me back up for a second. Thank you, by the way. Let me start with that. Thank you for raising a very important and serious question. And I think that all of the commissioners have been grappling with this and have been working in good faith to try and figure out what is the best way to answer it. I assume we can all take it as a given. I hope you do, that everyone is concerned with the safety of members of Congress, and no one wants anyone to be unsafe or to feel unsafe. So, we can certainly, I think, all start with that as a first principle. I originally thought this was going to be an easier answer than it turned out to be, the more I thought about it. I actually think the request about, putting in security lights, security cameras, hiring one of those companies that, you punch a panic button or whatever for people's homes, was in some ways a more straightforward question than this one. And it you raised this question with the backdrop. I mean, you didn't mention in your request the events of January 6th, but that has been very present in my mind as I've been thinking about how to address this question, certainly raises serious concerns about safety, not to mention the fact that in the past week we've seen two mass shootings, one of which certainly raises some concerns of people being targeted on the basis of gender and or race. So there's a pretty fraught backdrop to all of this, and it's been suggested, and there was an article in Business Insider this morning, that there could be unintended consequences to a broad response. I'll fess up. I asked to have revised draft A, which I styled that way because it is pretty close to the original draft, put on the agenda, not because I thought these particular words were the precise and perfect way of addressing a concern that I was starting to have. And then, this morning woke up and read in Business Insider that apparently other people were having it as well. But because it seemed to me that in order to avoid unintended consequences, perhaps some additional language was warranted. I would actually feel more comfortable if we could put that language out and for public comment for a couple of weeks and see if somebody else has a better way of framing it. Because as I said, I'm not pretending that's the perfect solution, but I think the intent was to try and get out exactly what you just said, that the assumption here is that what the request is asking about is professional, legitimate, bona fide. I mean, I don't know that those words are entirely clear on their face either, but I think we're all talking about the same thing. Let me ask you another question though. This request is from the party committees on behalf of half of the members of Congress and would certainly be relied on by all members of Congress. Why the party committees? Why are you requesting this?
Certainly. Might I just add one important clarification, I think, for the record to your earlier point? I just want to state clearly that I actually don't think draft B, as we've been referring to it, is in keeping with our request. I do think the additional hurdles regarding the licensure and bonding and insurance requirements certainly add another layer that frankly wasn't present in the advisory opinion in 2017. There was no requirement in the 2017-07 advisory opinion that the people installing the security apparatuses be licensed or experienced or have any sort of certain qualifications. It was just noted that this was important, that time was of the essence, and we must move forward. And so it was permitted. And so we were asking for the same treatment here. And so I just wanted to be clear that, you know, we respectfully do disagree that B is in keeping with our request because we think it is importantly distinct. As far as the question about whether we're asking on behalf of the party committees, I think that as party committee counsel and as committees wholly, I think your job, if you do it well, is to support the, you know, members and candidates that you work with. And so because this is unfortunately not hypothetical, but because it's also not limited to one particular member or senator, unfortunately, this is a incident and a pain that's being felt widely by many people in our caucus on both sides of the aisle, might I add. You know, we thought it was certainly an appropriate thing for the party committees to ask in support of their members and candidates.
Well, as you know, we have a statutory hurdle that we have to get past, which is that an advisory request, an advisory opinion can only be issued to a person in relation to a transaction or activity that person is planning on undertaking. And it is not the party committees themselves that would be undertaking this. You've referred several times already to the Sergeant at Arms opinion, which frankly we kind of bent the rules on that one due to the exigent circumstances. But honestly, I don't think that I would have been able to get there had not we had a letter from an actual member of Congress, Congressman Harper, who wrote to us with a comment that pretty much re-asked the same question. He didn't formally join in the request, but we did have an actual member of Congress whose name was on the line, so to speak, on that one, even though we formally issued the opinion to the Sergeant at Arms. And we did that because of the exit. You know, we probably should have made them go back and swap it so that the member was asking the request and the Sergeant at Arms was issuing the comment, but we didn't do that due to the exigent circumstances. But I do think that it's I do wonder why there are no members of Congress who have joined in this request. You know, would have been a simple matter for someone to submit a one sentence letter saying, I join in this request. You are here on behalf of many members of Congress. And yet the request cites to newspaper articles about what anonymous members of Congress have said about their concerns rather than having an actual member of Congress voice their own concerns. So it's a little bit one step removed, and I don't want to be overly technical here because I recognize we are talking about the safety of members of Congress and it is a very important concern, but I guess I'm still just a little bit puzzled as to why there is not, I don't know, someone from leadership or, you know, Mr. Harper back in the earlier one was the chair of House Administration, I think, and then wrote in that capacity why there is no member of Congress who wanted to put their name on this.
Certainly. Well, I mean, as you've noted, you know, this is not in keeping with what the commission has done previously. There are other examples of advisory opinions. There was an advisory opinion issued in 2006 where a party committee was making a request on behalf of campaign committees, and that was also approved. I believe it was with respect to some of the legal or building funds. So this is not the first time that this has been done. And again, as you noted, as was true with the 2017 opinion, the same is unfortunately true today. This was a very urgent matter. And, you know, we've now waited 2 months from the time we filed the opinion, and we think time is of the essence. And so that, you know, was another important consideration here. But I would also note, unfortunately, that while I'm certain that there, you know, would be many members, again, on both sides of the aisle who would be willing to say that this is important, as we've just seen last night, you know, unfortunately, it's still possible that this is made into a political request, which is certainly was not the intent. The intent was apolitical, bipartisan, legitimate request for security. And just in the past 12 hours, suggestions have been made that, you know, that the intent was something else. And so you can certainly understand that, you know, were we to attach any specific member's name to that, we'd basically be feeding them to the wolves, as, you know, unfortunately, detractors like to try to make politics out of something that was certainly not that.
Yeah. And I would add that we're, as a party committee, we are uniquely situated, as we all know, kind of in the FICA, you know, it's just three on each side, and we do have a uniquely, like, representative, collaborative situation with respect to candidates.
Well, I mean, part of what you said suggests to me, though, you said it was a bipartisan request. It's not technically a bipartisan request, but it is, it's going to be used by both sides.
And I hope so. Yes,
that is certainly true. It will be relied on by members on both sides of
the
aisle.
With all due respect, Commissioner, there was a tweet last night where the Democrats, I think it was on Democracy Docket, claimed that they had asked for it. They had asked for this request. They publicly tweeted that. So it sounds like it is bipartisan. We're happy to hear that. We think it's important for both sides.
I did not see that tweet. I was not on Twitter last night because I was thinking about this. But that's interesting. But does that suggest, I mean, if this is really a request on behalf, essentially, of all members of Congress, does that suggest that this would be better addressed through a rulemaking? I mean, I think that I'm somewhat hesitant to suggest that because obviously, that would take longer, and I do recognize that there are some exigent circumstances here. But is this? I mean, you guys are lawyers. You're well familiar with the FICA. Is this the sort of thing that the commission ought to address through a rulemaking, so that we could get more comments? We could get a fuller record, and perhaps put to rest some of the concerns that that some people have suggested.
So I don't think that's necessary because of how logical of an extension.
Sorry, I lost.
Madam Chair, we appear to have.
Have we lost the requesters?
They're still on, but their video stopped. Mr. Dollar? Yes. Ms. First, Mr. Dollar, this is Laura Sinner with the Federal Election Commission. Can you hear me?
There. I think the video is now back on, Madam Secretary, but I'm not sure if we have audio.
We lost it again.
Well,
we're getting it. Let's see.
Yeah, do you want to just do that? Yeah.
Madam Secretary, we're just going to do like a 5-minute recess so that we can check to ask them maybe to log out, log back in so that we can.
Yes, I can pause the live feed if you would like, ma'am.
Thank you.
Jim, could you please pause your recording? Jim, you should be seeing that shortly. And if you could let me know when that we are live on YouTube again. Thank you. Madam Chair, you may reconvene the meeting when ready.
Thank you. We're going to resume our open meeting. We had a little technical difficulties, as what happens nowadays. So I believe at this moment the requesters were responding. If you would like to proceed.
Yeah, so as to the question of a rulemaking, I think that, our first priority is to get our AO approved now. And, you know, we are not necessarily opposed to an eventual rulemaking. I'm not sure if I find a rulemaking necessary because of 113.2 and the sergeant at arms AO, and I mean, just a long line of AOs here, seem to make this a straightforward request, but so not necessarily opposed to rulemaking, but today we are hoping to just get our advisory opinion approved.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you. You had said that in the Sergeant at Arms, we didn't set criteria for the technical skills of the people who would be installing the security systems at the homes of members. And that's true, but this is really quite different. And the more I think about it, the more different I think it is. This question arises as part of a broader debate, which certainly I'm not suggesting that we're going to settle here today or at the FEC, but there is a much larger issue that is being debated right now about the impact on democracy, the impact on who we are as Americans when members of Congress feel the need to wall themselves off from the general public. And, you know, there's a debate going on about the fencing that was put around the Capitol and how much of the Capitol complex needs to be fenced off. And that fencing has been, you know, withdrawn to some degree. It's been pulled back so that a little bit more space is outside the fencing, but there's still fencing around the Capitol. And a lot of people are actively debating whether that is a good thing to have the People's House, the Capitol of the United States, not be a space where the American people can freely come and go. And the notion of members of Congress having armed guards around them to be interposed between the elected representatives of the people and people who may want to express their opinions to the people, to their elected representatives. And, you know, people sometimes have fervent views that they want to express. And I've never thought of us as a country where the leadership of the country had to be surrounded by armed guards and needed to keep the public at arm's length at all times. But, you know, it's a, as I said, I don't think we're going to resolve all of those questions here today, but it does raise for me the issue that we, I think however we do this, we want to make sure that it's done in a way that there are professionals who are, you know, like I said, I'm not sure what the precise words are, but I think we do want to ensure, I would want to ensure that the people who would be in a position to perhaps block members of the public from access to their elected leaders, one would hope that they would be doing it in a way that was sensitive to the First Amendment concerns of, you know, members of the public who might want to approach somebody in an airport. The airport example I thought was actually interesting, since everybody's got to pass through a metal detector before they get to the gate. So, you know, when you're sitting in the waiting room of an airport, yeah, you're kind of a captive audience. But at the same time, that might be one of the safer places that you could be, because it's the least likely place where somebody's going to pull a weapon. my point, though, is that the need for professionalism on the part of anyone who might seek to interfere with a member of the public trying to express their views to their to the elected leadership of the country, that is quite a different question than the guy who comes to your house and is installing a security system. Those people are not going to be having any are not going to be interfering with members of the public as they try and express their views to their elected leadership. So I do think that it's a which is one of the reasons why I think it would benefit from a little bit more comment on exactly how one would go about crafting the guidance that would avoid the unintended, that would avoid unduly burdening the members who are trying to protect themselves, but also avoid the unintended consequences that at least some people have raised concerns about, should there be no criteria whatsoever.
Sure. And with all due respect, you know, we're not talking about people who are showing up at homes in the middle of the night to have a nice conversation about legislation. We're talking about situations where members are unfortunately feeling threatened with their children in their homes in the middle of the night by people who don't, again, intend to just express their First Amendment on, you know, the way that the members is representing them, or certainly not doing it in a way that any of us would agree is appropriate or responsible. And certainly, as Ryan noted, you know, we're not opposed to a rulemaking. We are opposed to dragging this out longer than we think is necessary. And again, given the precedent, given the regulations, given the statutes, we think this is a perfectly permissible use of campaign funds. It's certainly another lawful purpose as set forth in the regulation. And we would encourage the commission to, in light of the current threat environment, to, you know, put a priority on protecting these members and their families now.
Could I ask if you have just one more question, if I may, Madam Chair? Could I ask if you have any suggestions for wording that might I think we're all talking about the same thing, honestly, and I wonder if you have any suggestions for us as to how best to frame that notion of bona fide, legitimate, professional criteria that might be appropriate to put in the advisory opinion, but that would not unduly burden the members who are seeking to protect themselves.
I'm not sure if I have any language off the top of my head, but I am skeptical that any members or senators are going to hire anyone but professional, legitimate security when it involves them and their own families. I think it's sort of built into, you know, the requests and the language. I think it's fairly assumed that it will be professional security now when it involves a person and their family.
And for that reason, I think we would suggest that less is more. You know, we would suggest that professional and bona fide, you know, are enough, are the words that can be used. And should something else need to be addressed, it can be addressed at a later time. But again, given the threat environment, you know, I don't know that it's appropriate, certainly not timely, to, you know, undergo a you know, search for the perfect word that would eliminate all potential for misuse. I mean, certainly, commission has not, you know, has not sought to ensure in every advisory opinion that every potential word is defined to a T perfectly without any confusion. And that's certainly why advisory opinions have been revisited and revised over time. So we think the threat environment necessitates quick and urgent action. And we certainly would think that professional, bona fide, legitimate are words that provide enough guidance at this point to get us moving in the right direction.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all I have right now.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. I want to join in some of the concerns that Commissioner Weintraub has mentioned and reiterate that everybody, I'm sure if I ask, they'd all shake their head, is that we're concerned about the safety of the office holders and want to come up with some resolution. But the comment received last night and in the Business Insider article, they do bring those questions of how do we create not limitations for the officeholder, but some limiting factors. And this is not an interest in me to try to make it burdensome in any way. But we just asked the requesters, and you use the words bona fide and legitimate, but we're not able to define them right now to any comfort level that it lends to some. It lends in some way that maybe this should be a notice and comment, an opportunity for the community to be able to weigh in. So I want to highlight that I'm supportive of the, I think it's called revised draft A. I'm happy to kind of take some additional time. I know we don't have that, but additional time to try to flesh out the bona fide legitimate language. In an effort to try to find some way, is there any interest in the requesters in granting additional time for us to try to see if we can find some compromise to work on something that can get answers? And I do recognize that a good bit of time has elapsed in your request and there is an urgent need, but I want to ask you, would you be willing to grant an extension for the commission to have some additional consideration?
I mean, we reiterate that we don't think it's necessary. And frankly, it's mm-hmm. a little disappointing because it does feel, like the motivation, was a little bit political, based on the comments that were made, publicly. I haven't read the Business Insider article, but certainly on Twitter, and in the, response to the draft interpretive rule, which I notice has since been removed from the agenda. We don't think the additional time is necessary, but we ultimately, very legitimately want our members to be protected. And that's first goal here. We just think it's clear from the regulations that this is a permissible use of campaign funds.
Yeah. And, again, this is urgent. And if a vendor, a security vendor, acts inappropriately, there are other mechanisms for that. The disbursements are disclosed. And so the public kind of knows about it. And if they, break the law, that's for law enforcement. And so that just goes back to our earlier point that the intention here is for good security because of, what's at stake. So we don't think it would be wise to delay this further just, for some hypothetical that is both unlikely and has other mechanisms for addressing.
Yeah, we also can't help but note that, again, the request was made on January 26th and not 12 hours before the hearing were these concerns raised. So that I think also is slightly frustrating and certainly is problematic if the goal is to allow these members to protect themselves and their families quickly, which that is the goal.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair.
You've made several allusions to it, but I want to ask the question directly. I know you're referring to the CCC and DSCC comments that we got at least at 3:30 yesterday afternoon. And I have a great deal of sympathy for my colleagues who scrambled to respond to that late submission. But it seemed to me like the center of their objection was a reading of ambiguity into the term security personnel that required additional language, so whether it was bona fide or legitimate or any of these other questions that, the other terms we're having difficulty defining here at the table. I guess my question to you, just as a legal matter, as a matter of interpretation of English language, do you think their reading of the term security personnel as advanced in the interpretive rule by the chair and by Commissioner Weintraub was a reasonable or fair reading of the interpretive rule? You think it required this gloss, or was the plain language simple and unambiguous on its face?
Commissioner, I would propose that the plain language was simple and unambiguous on its face.
It was also my sense, but I wanted to make sure I wasn't
yes.
crazy. I will say, just for the record, that I found those comments very unfair to the chair and Commissioner Weintraub in their interpretation of what I thought was plain, and you know, whatever disagreements we may have on this on the procedure, the idea that, you know, security personnel is thugs hired to harass your opponents is not a reasonable reading. I don't think one any of us would adopt in an enforcement context. So I appreciate your thoughts on that. I wanted to give you a chance to directly answer.
Thank you.
Any Madam further? Chair. Yes, Commissioner Traynor.
I have a question for OGC with regard to draft B and this inclusion of an insurance and a bonding requirement. Do we have any sense of whether every state requires an insurance and a bonding requirement for, and I assume in a lot of cases this is going to be law enforcement personnel working an extra job to make ends meet. And so I don't want to put in place a requirement for one of our first responders to go out and acquire insurance or acquire a bond when the state or the municipality that they may be working for doesn't necessarily require that. And so I just wonder if we have any sense of what the 50 states, what the district, Puerto Rico, everywhere, whether or not there are bonding and insurance requirements for law enforcement personnel in every circumstance in order for them to be able to meet this definition of bona fide security personnel. Cause I don't want to impose that type of burden on a first responder who's really probably doing this as a way to make ends meet. And I know that happens a lot in my home state of Texas, where, you know, we have law enforcement who work at grocery stores and places like that to provide security. So, I've just addressed that for OGC to see if they've had the ability to look at that.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Knott. Go ahead, Mr. Knott. Thank you.
No, we have not had an opportunity to look into that yet. With the draft having come out late last night, between then and now, no, we have not taken a look at that. We would be happy to look into it. But I can't provide you with any kind of an answer that I'm confident about at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Knott.
Any further questions for requesters or the Office of General Counsel?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Walker.
I do have a couple of questions on, and I must confess I've been of the view that this is very important and has a lot to do with how people are able or not to have a reasonable amount of assistance in security. But looking at it from the Federal Election Commission provision, I can see where there would be a lot of issues that will arise for us to deal with in connection with maybe the administration of this and whether or not campaign funds were really actually spent for this purpose or whether there was more than should or not. And as you might imagine, we get a lot of complaints for a lot of different reasons, and many are legitimate and some aren't. But I'm a little bit concerned as I go that this seems to show so that any candidate or any person who's a federal elected employee can have unlimited amounts of money for that purpose. Or you might well find somebody who's running for office who has real no campaign finance money, but who might have the same kind of risks. I'm just wondering, where's the cutoff there in terms of security? And also with respect to family composition. Someone might be in terms of protecting it, but also insurance for liability purposes. If are certain members of the family really covered and some not able to, or thought on that? I mean, there's a real mix that could take place when you have kids and a couple of families and they go to the beach for 10 days and come back, and some still are working in the D.C. Attending these hearings. So we, how does that get balanced in the application of something like this?
Well, thank you, Commissioner. First, I would note, just as a point of clarification, that we did limit the request to office holders, primarily because we thought that was best in keeping with the previous advisory opinions the commission had issued, and in an effort to have this request granted expediently. We didn't want to ask to break new ground or pose a question of first impression. So this the question and the request was limited to office holders. I think as far as the family arrangements, as was noted in the comment to the draft interpretive rule by the DSCC, I think we're incredibly open to any sort of family arrangement, and we certainly obviously would be in favor of the members and senators protecting themselves and their families as they see fit. Practically speaking, I would note that, you know, I think the folks and the members that get into this business, they're wanting to represent their constituents and their states. And they certainly aren't, I don't think, looking to drain their whole campaign account on security funds. Now, I mean, as a mom myself, I can tell you I'd do that if that's what I had to do to protect my children. And it's unfortunate, as Commissioner Weintraub noted, that we've got to this place in society where this is necessary. I don't suppose to, you know, put any boundaries on this, but I do think that what has become clear, unfortunately, is that this protection is necessary. Certainly because these members are office holders, it is directly connected. The but-for test is met here. And so we would be in favor of permitting the use of campaign funds, as we think is permitted under the regulations, to any family arrangements and to office holders as they see fit.
So then who would be the one to determine what's either bona fide or legitimate or whatever adjective we end up having? Who's going to make that decision? Will it have to be run by, for example, us to say, is this a legitimate expenditure because of this is breaking new ground?
Yes, Commissioner, I think that's the crux of what we've been discussing this morning. I think, again, when we approached this question, it was from the position that there is a need and there is a threat, and that, you know, it never crossed our mind, frankly, that these expenses would be used for anything other than legitimate bona fide security. And we think that, given the threat environment and given that we're talking about protecting members and their families, that it is important to approve this and that these members will do as best fit to protect their families. And I think I don't remember which commissioner previously noted it, but, you know, the suggestion that a member would choose a thug to protect their family as opposed to a professional, I think is somewhat silly to me. And I think the fact that we're debating that, I'm not quite sure how we got here, but, you know, I think our position was that this is an urgent need, as was the case in 2017, that legitimate and bona fide, it's like the word obscenity, you know it when you see it, and we all agree legally that you know, we know what that is, and we think it's urgently necessary for the commission to approve that.
Yes. What happens to the person who they use campaign funds, and so you have a candidate or somebody who just got elected and they busted flat from having to spend the money necessary to get elected, to me, it seems a little bit uneven to deal with it in a way where a very legitimate gift could occur, but there's no campaign funds per se that are there. Or maybe it's unclear when the final tab comes in, how much it's going to be. And just the practical concerns that someone might have if, if the money is not there. And yet there may be people who have a lot of money, and so they quickly get, risk-free expenditures, and they can travel and all of that. I'm a little concerned with that. And I have one other issue that I'd like to ask you to consider. I understand, and I believe me, but I have not got any detailed information, that there was some recent money that was made available, like $68,000, for to ameliorate some of the security issues. And I'm just wondering, was there any attitude that you have been aware of in Congress of any kind to take up that issue and deal with it for all the people in an equal way who are elected to Congress?
Yeah, so I'm not aware of legislation, but I would say that I think campaign funds are probably a better use than taxpayer dollars. I think that would be a much better solution.
Thank you. I, with respect to the previous comments about the need for something like a rule, I think we ought to have a hearing and let everybody, all sides of the political environment and the people who else might be affected by it, to get some more input before I would be comfortable with the lack of clarity that's there. But I am not opposed at all to the idea of providing security. But at this point, for me, I think it's premature for me to support today.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. Are there any further questions for Council or OGC? I'm going to actually ask to take a 15-minute recess, Madam Secretary.
Yes, ma'am. Are you ready to begin that recess?
Yes.
All right. Jim, if you could let me know when our feed has started again. Thank you. Madam Chair, we are live recording and you may resume the meeting when ready.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. We are resuming the open meeting for the Federal Election Commission. I first want to say thank you to everyone for your indulgence, because this was far longer than the 15 minutes that I highlighted, but I appreciate everyone's patience with us today as we try to work forward on this one. I'm going to put it out to any commissioners if there's any further questions for the requesters are OGC.
Madam Chair, I have a motion if there is not.
Yes. Vice Chair.
In AO 2021-03, I move approval of original draft A of the agenda document 21-19 alpha, with the addition of adding the phrase bona fide and legitimate as appropriate in the following lines. Page 1, line 16, page 3, line 4, and page 5, lines 3 and 8, and I would ask to direct the Office of General Counsel to add that phrase before descriptions of security personnel if I have missed any such instances.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Is there a discussion on this motion? Actually, I'm going to back up. If you can give us those locations again so I can follow along with the draft, I'd appreciate it.
Of course, Madam Chair. Page 1, line 16. Page 3, line 4, and page 5 at lines 3 and 8.
Thank you. Is there a discussion on the motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Walther?
I intend to ask for a motion to consider the issues that we're talking about today through a rulemaking. So whatever approach would be procedurally the best, I'd like to just, I want to let you know that, so that I'd like to make sure we do that in the proceedings today.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. We will, I'm sure there everyone be eager to entertain the motion at the time when we do not have this motion right in front of us, and we'll turn back to that very shortly. Is there any further discussion on this motion? Commissioner Weintraub?
All right. So first, give me the page and line references again.
I believe my motion also includes a request to OGC for conforming edits. So if I've missed any, hopefully I've covered that. But it should be page 1, line 16, page 3, line 4, and page 5 at lines 3 and 8.
And the addition?
The addition is the words bona fide and legitimate before descriptions of security personnel. I believe that tracks what we've discussed here at the table.
Hello. I didn't want to interrupt you, Commissioner Weintraub. Is there an interest in adding that language to the question?
Well, I'd like to get a vote on this motion. I would ask if there's, I guess, a question of parliamentary procedure. What is the procedure for doing so with a motion of this sort on the table? And is this, can we in fact modify the underlying AOR?
We will wait for our trusty, as I like to call him, the oracle. You might not want everyone to know that outside of the building, but.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I need to ask for a clarification. You're talking about adding the direction regarding a rulemaking from that Commissioner Walther mentioned, or something else that I missed?
Something else. So two questions. The first is, related questions. So when speaking of parliamentarian, I feel this need to disaggregate things. The first question is, may we modify the language of the AOR as filed by the requester? The second question is, if such is permissible, what is the procedure? And the third question is, assuming that it matters, does the procedure differ given that there is a motion already upon the table?
I guess I'm having a little trouble following. I don't know that the commission can modify the language of the request. The requester is free to do what they want with their request, and I may need to ask my colleagues in the policy division to help out some on the answer to this question on how, if there was agreement that it would be helpful for the requester to modify the request, how that would go about doing that in a situation like this at the table. I think that's the first and second question. I'm sorry, Mr. Vice Chair, could you give me the third again?
The third is whether your answer would change given there's already a motion upon the table, but it sounds like the answer is no to that,
right?
That last issue.
And in terms of how to go about modifying the request, I would defer to my colleagues in the OGC policy division.
Madam Chair.
Okay, go ahead, Devin.
Go ahead, Mr. Stefante.
Yeah, I think the easiest way to do this would be to allow the requester to grant consent to modify the question. That would be the easiest thing to do here.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Mr. Knott.
Maybe I misunderstood, but I thought the Vice Chair was talking about modifying the language in the answer, in the draft answer, as opposed to in the request itself. He did also have a question about whether to change the, or someone had a question about whether to change the question as represented in the draft AO. But I thought the primary question was, could he at the table modify the language of the answer in the draft AO?
I think what's happening is there being two answers to the question. Mr. Stepanovic is answering my question, and Mr. Knopf is answering, I believe, the vice chair's question. But let me allow the vice chair, please, weigh in.
I think this is very interesting, and I would eventually like to get you know, to Delphi Actual's level of knowledge of the parliamentary procedures. But I think for purposes of my motion, I take counsel as having already given us at least oral permission at the table to incorporate this. And frankly, I'm not sure we require their permission to add these languages to our response to their question. I'm seeing head nods for the record, which, yeah, I'm not sure that's an appropriate way of putting something in the record, but we're all working on it.
I'll defer. Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Calvert, please.
Yes, just to clarify what I had said earlier. In terms of modifying the request, it's up to the requester to do that. In terms of proposing an amendment to the language of the answer of the draft, the commission is, any commissioner, it's an amendable document. Any commissioner is fully able to propose an amendment to our answer to their question.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
In light of that colloquy, I'm comfortable going forward on a vote on the motion.
Thank you. So any further discussion on the motion of the Vice Chair? Then, yes, Commissioner Weintraub.
Just sort of as a point of information, it's quite typical, actually, for us to include within the AO language that says this is based on your request and information provided at the meeting of, in this case, March 25th. We have frequently amended things at the table based on the discussion at the meeting. Sometimes we do it multiple times. We will amend the document. We'll have one discussion. We'll have one discussion, and then we hold over the matter until the next meeting. And we could have, and based on the discussion at two consecutive meetings. So I just want to assure my colleagues that this is not unusual. And while it would be neater and I think more relaxing for all of us if we had everything lined up before we came into the meeting and then we could just, make a motion and vote for things, this kind of an extended back and forth and taking recesses and rewriting at the table, that also has happened many, many times in the agency's history. And I'm reminded of the time that I chaired the meeting, and it was also our first take your kid to work day, and we had a very complicated AO. So we were doing all of this with multiple breaks and trying to rewrite the language while we had 100 kids running around our ankles in the building. So this is actually much more orderly than some meetings we have had in the past. And having said all of that, I also want to point out that we also were working on scribbling during the break and trying to figure out how to get to a yes here. And I believe that we have just circulated a revised draft A in both. I think we have asked for the document to be made blue as well as asked for the draft to be circulated to be sent to the requesters in both clean and redline version to point out the changes. So check your emails. I mean, if we were in person, we would be scurrying around handing out pieces of blue paper so that everybody could see it. But we're doing everything electronically today.
And with that, I think that with Madam sufficient Chair. Time. Yes, Vice Chair.
No, I appreciate the warning. I think the first thing I'd say is that in the current environment, every day is take your child to work day. So yes, I have some sympathy for what that must have looked like, though, we are not so fecund as to have 100 children. But I assure you 2 is quite enough. On the various dueling drafts, I just don't want there to be any surprise, and I don't want to stand up in a motion to reconsider or unable to reach this. you know, this I think the motion on the table, in my view, addresses the concerns that have been raised. It does not include some of the background information that was provided to us late last night. And I understand that there's a practice of revising things on the table. In all frankness among colleagues, I came here in part to revise some of our policies that may have been trending towards disorder. So I don't intend to support that draft. I'll let my other colleagues speak for themselves, but this is obviously harder when we can't just get in a room and talk. So we're having to do it live. And I would be very disappointed to see this draft go down and see the other draft fail and see us fail to provide guidance because of line edits added that could have been added earlier in the process. The edits that I've suggested, I think, are things that have arisen organically in the last 24 hours. I'm not sure that's true for other revisions. So I just want to forecast where I'm at. If anyone else wants to, you know, we're debating the motion, but it does seem relevant. There's some game theory here.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Commissioner Traynor.
I would move the previous question.
Thank you, Commissioner Traynor. We have a motion before us. I'm going to now call the question. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, please say no.
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 The motion fails with 3 voting in favor, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Cooksey, and Commissioner Traynor, and 3 voting against, Commissioner Walter, Commissioner Weintraub, and myself. Thank you. Are there any further motions?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Walther, I believe, let me, 1 second. Commissioner Walther, feel free, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure procedurally where we are at the tail end of the conversations there. So whenever it's appropriate to make a motion, I would do that. Okay. Respect to.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. I appreciate that. There any other motions? Commissioner Weintraub.
I will ask counsel whether do we have to I know that my staff has emailed something, but is it an official blue draft yet? Is it something that we can discuss?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Ms. Stevens.
Is my understanding that that document is in the process of being tried to meet blue, but we have not yet had a sufficient time to do so.
I can't understand that. It must be at least 30 seconds.
We are working on it ASAP, but it has not yet made so.
It's harder when I can't see the blue paper in front of me.
There is no blue paper. So, working on it.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Commissioner Weintraub.
I'm sorry to have to do this, but might I suggest that we take another short recess so that the document can be made blue and people can have a chance to look at it?
Of course. We are going to take a recess. I will suggest that it will be 15 minutes, but we see how that has gone so far today. So we're again, let's say 15 minutes, but if we do not find that the requesters have not received the document, we'll of course make sure there's adequate time for you all to have the opportunity to review. So thank you, Madam Secretary.
Yes, ma'am. Jim, can you go ahead and let me know when we're up and running again on YouTube, please? Thank you, Madam Chair. We are live recording and you may resume the meeting when ready.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. We are resuming the the open meeting for Thursday, March 25th. Again, I do want to say to the requesters, thank you for your continued indulgence. So are there any, I believe we do have a motion that we need to proceed with.
Madam Chair, I have a special motion.
I
move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the commission may consider agenda document number 21-19C.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair. Is there any discussion on this motion? Seeing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 I have not seen that. It's not a submission, of course.
Thank you. The motion passes 6-0.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
I move the adoption of the second revised draft A, document 21-19-C.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Is there a discussion on this motion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair.
Just briefly, and I don't want to further belabor this. I'm comfortable making this motion because I don't see substantive differences between the motion that was already voted down and this draft. And I'm glad we can put this to bed. I have some hope that in the future we can do it further in advance. We did have a flu draft sitting out there for a few days. So hopefully we can move towards a more orderly approach to these matters going forward, but I'd like to see the respondents or the requesters get the relief they're requesting.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I would agree with that. I think that the two of us have spoken and don't want to share any of that, but both believe the need to work as far in advance and as expeditiously as possible. And I think that we all can agree on that. And I look forward to pushing that further along with you. But any discussion on this motion? Seeing no interest, I will call the question. Yes, Commissioner Walker.
Sorry, I'm just curious to know of the impact of that. If this motion passes, then that will eliminate the need for any further voting on whether or not to go forward.
Go forward on any
potential. To actually formally create the mechanism to begin to implement this.
I don't want to put any words. Are you talking about in the sense of moving with any potential rulemaking? Is that what you're talking about?
Again, I was wanting to be in a position to make a motion, but if it sounds to me like this will cut that off.
No, I don't believe that it will cut it off at all. Personally, and only speaking for myself, I see that as we're looking at providing some guidance to the requesters and those members of Congress now. But from the discussion that we've had today and quite a significant back and forth, there are still other points that need to be resolved that I personally would be supportive if there is a motion that would be coming for rulemaking. I do not think it circumvents any potential future actions by the commission.
Wouldn't be timely to make that motion to the meeting after this vote, though.
Yes, I believe so.
It would be or not be?
It would be.
Okay.
Thank you. Are there any further discussion? Then I'm going to call the question. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
Thank you. The motion passes with 5 voting in favor, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Cooksey, Commissioner Traynor, Commissioner Weintraub, and myself, and the Commissioner Walker voting against the motion. Thank you. Thank you to the requesters for your patience in these regards, and we appreciate your appearance today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to move ahead to, I'm not sure if anyone heard me during one of the many breaks. We're going to move straight to advisory opinion 2021-01, Illuminate Incorporated, submitted by... Yes.
I apologize, but just before we move on, in light of Commissioner Walter's question.
Oh, I apologize. Thank you. Thank you.
Can we ask unanimous consent to consider the opening of a rulemaking on this matter? I'm not sure of the procedure, but I'd like to get that vote on the table.
Yes. Thank you for that. I totally, in the scheme of all the time we spent on the others, was just jumping ahead. So I do apologize, Commissioner Walter. You had indicated an interest in proceeding or opening, directing the commission, OGC, to begin a rulemaking. I believe everybody has indicated, at least by nodding heads, that they have some interest in this as well. But would you like to make a formal direction to OGC, and the vice chair has said he would, obviously there'll be unanimous consent, I believe.
Well, I can do that. I think, Chair, I would move that we begin to explore the ways in which we can better implement the procedure that we've just voted on and have been encompassed and considered in the recent motions at this meeting and some previous outside comment regarding whether or not to implement a program to assist financially and elected federal officials on security reasons, and that we attempt to implement that and take all deliberate speed to consider it and act on it.
Thank you, Commissioner Walker. I believe I had the vice chair, but did I kind of interrupted you when you were speaking to, thank you for putting us back on course to where we needed to be. Did you also want to move forward with this direction? It's not no necessary for a formal motion for this, but I do believe it's in fairness so that everybody here that's interested, I will take that as a motion from Commissioner Welker. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
I mean, I guess mostly some background, partially a clarification. You know, as many of the people on inside the building, the proverbial building these days, are aware, Commissioner Weintraub and I on the Regulations Committee have already had substantive discussions along the lines of initiating a rulemaking on this matter. I wonder if, just for purposes of formality, if Commissioner Walther would have considered a friendly amendment to his motion to instruct the Regulations Committee to proceed with all deliberate speed to open an NPRM on the subject of candidate security broadly, and to open the notice and comment period at the earliest opportunity, or words to that effect.
Of course. Of course. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
In that case, ma'am, I'd move the previous question.
Thank you. The question has been moved. Any further discussion? Seeing none, I'm going to call the question. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. 6-0. Thank you very much. Thank you, Commissioner Walker, and thank you to the Vice Chair. And now we are going to move on to Advisory Opinion 2021-01, Illuminate Incorporated, submitted by Robert Fealty. We're joined today, I believe, by Mr. Fealty, the president and founder of Illuminate, and Rashika Condavita, director of data analytics at Illuminate. I did see their images pop up for just a second ago, so.
Yes, hello, Madam Chair. We are here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome. We have Mr. Joseph Weinzinger and Amy Rothstein from the Office of General Counsel here to discuss. So, counsel, if you would like to proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Broussard. Good morning, commissioners. Agenda documents 2115A and 2115B are draft responses to an advisory opinion request submitted by Illuminate. The requester, a for-profit corporation, asks whether it may use individual contributors' data obtained from commission reports in providing commercial services to universities, colleges, and not-for-profit corporations. Draft A concludes that Illuminate may not use contributor data as proposed, because the data would be used to enhance Illuminate's clients' fundraising efforts, and such use constitutes a solicitation or commercial purpose in violation of the Act and Commission regulations. Draft B, by contrast, concludes that Illuminate may use contributor data as proposed because the data, which is generalized and would not include any individual's contact information, would be insufficient to generate solicitations and thus is in compliance with the Act and Commission regulations. We received no comments on the request and two comments on draft A. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Cooksey.
In the interest of brevity, I'll try to reduce this to one question to Mr. Weinzinger. It is the case in the draft B, the draft that approves the request, that we make specific note, and I think this is consistent with the framing of their request, that nothing that the requester engages in or nothing part of their product produces additional contact information, or nor does it verify the current status or the correctness of any addresses that their clients may already have. Is that right?
Yes, that is my understanding. It may be worth getting confirmation from Mr. Feely, though.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. We have a number of different vendors that we use today for address information, telephones, emails, and things like that. So the information that comes off of the FPC reports really is not that useful to us. It's not really useful at all. So we do not intend to use that information for any purpose whatsoever with our clients.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Weintraub.
I am now confused. If you don't intend to use the information from the FEC database for any purpose, then what is your request for?
Well, I can address that, Commissioner. So when we talk about using the address or the information that's in there, we're basically just trying to make sure that any of these indicators that we have suggested we'd like to use are based on the right individual. One of the most difficult things for universities, for colleges, and for not-for-profits is making sure that the information that they have and receive actually matches up with their own records. It doesn't sound very difficult, but there are a lot of people with very common names. And so part of our first step is an internal process to look at the information that is in the FPC reports and ensure that that's the same individual that we're talking about in the records of the not-for-profit. That's an internal process. From there, then, the next steps are the three things that we suggested in our proposal, which is the identification of indicators for things like interests and leadership and things like that. So in other words, what I'm saying is, you know, before we use, you know, to go any further, really, we have to make sure that the information that's on the FPC reports is the actual record that we're looking at from the university, college, or not-for-profit. That is an internal process.
Go ahead, Commissioner Weintraub.
But why is it important to you to know whether the people that you're talking to are the same people who are in the FEC database?
Well, the only thing we provide back to the colleges is information about what they have in their databases. We aren't looking for new individuals. This is all focused on records that they have in their database today. So we provide this information back to them, and the additional flags, as we call them, indicators or check marks, we have to make sure that those are related to the individual that's in their record. So, for instance, if we're doing a project, let's say, for a large university, which might have 1 million records, and we are helping them to update their records for some set of that, let's say 100,000, they're going to have a lot of individuals named with common names. I'll use John Smith as just a simple example. There in the FPC data, I'm sure there must be many individuals named John Smith. So we need to make sure that the individuals that are John Smith in their data records are the same ones that we're looking at in the FEC data before we go any further. If we don't have a high confidence match, we just discard it and do nothing with it.
But why does it matter? Why do your clients need to know whether the people they are soliciting are in the FEC database?
Well, let me go at that a different way. We are trying to provide to them several pieces of additional information, as we say in our proposal. You know, we're trying to identify any interests that might be helpful to them in their fundraising effort. We're trying to help them identify any leaders that might appear in FEC data. That's also, these individuals are, let's say, alumni of their school. And so what's important about this is that we make sure that we're not telling them that this information relates to an individual who is not actually, let's say, an alumni of their school. And this is a pervasive problem in most of this data that comes out of data vendors today, is ensuring that the records are accurately matched up.
Well, I'm very sympathetic to that concern, because there's actually a university out there that continues to send me alumni solicitations, and I've never had any association with that school, although apparently somebody else with my name has. So I recognize the problem, but when but it still sounds to me like what you are saying is you are going to use information in the FEC database to provide to your clients so that they can use it as part of their fundraising operation.
It is a very small part of what we provide to them. Yes, that is correct. And as you pointed out, one of the problems that they have, and what we are trying to do, is to help them become more efficient in their fundraising, so they're not sending you letters that are irrelevant. And so part of what we really work hard at is ensuring that we're providing to them good information. And I have to tell you, in a big data set, the amount of data that we can provide back to them, this high confidence data, is actually relatively small because of this problem of matching up data.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Cooksey, please.
If Commissioner Weintraub is finished. Sure. Mr. Field, I wanted to clarify something you had said earlier, Commissioner Weintraub. So you said, use the examples of many John Smiths and making sure you have the right John Smiths in the university, and that they're contacting the correct John Smith, as Mr. Weintraub said, is a prevalent issue for people with even less common names. Let me ask the most specific question I think I can. If you get data from a university that says, we think we have an alumni that says that's John Smith and he lives at 100 Elm Street, and then you look at the FEC data and you compare things and you think, oh, it looks like maybe John Smith has moved to 200 Oak Street. Do you tell the university that you think John Smith has moved, or do you just let them work with the address they already have?
Yeah, we, in many cases, Commissioner, we receive as many as 25 different addresses from the database from the university, let's say, because they track these things over time, of course. So they provide to us all of the addresses that they have in their database. But we are not giving back to them any information from the FEC data, because who knows whether that's correct or not either at the point in time. Much of this data is not even current, of course. So the person may have moved 4 or 5 times from the time that report was filed. So we don't put a lot of stock in the address it is that we see there, but what I'm saying is we might see that address in the university database as one of the 10 or 5 or whatever addresses that they might have, and we might see that in the FEC database. In that case, we know we have a higher confidence level that that is the individual that we're talking about. But if it's a different address, we don't tell them there's a different address in there.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when you collect this information about interests and leadership roles, that is for the purpose of establishing rapport during the fundraising call so that you can have a good conversation so that your clients can have a good conversation that might more productively lead to somebody giving money to their institution?
Not necessarily. We have assignments. We've had a couple of recent assignments where the universities came to us and said, we are trying to find future trustees for our organization. It really wasn't about the fundraising side of it so much as it was to identify advisory board members or future board members for those organizations. So we do a combination of different things. It's not just solely for fundraising purposes. Now, on the other hand,
but it is somewhat for fundraising purposes, right?
I was going to say that. I was going to continue. Yes. So, you know, once they see and understand, we are also collecting data about these individuals from lots of different sources to understand, you know, what is their profession? You know, are they presidents of museums or business executives or prominent people? And so we've received information from a number of different sources already. And so, you know, what's interesting from the, you know, let me give you a better example, okay, perhaps. So once we have an individual, if our algorithms go through and find an individual that's in the FEC database, that's also in the university database, and we see that, and we see that that individual is given to the Humane Society, for instance, PAC, we're interested really in ESG type of organizations. We're not interested in politics. We're really interested in ESG type of organizations. So that is an interesting factor that the individual is given to the Humane Society. And so we would probably flag that as a possible interest. Now, at the same time, we're going to have information also from other sources that say perhaps we actually have one piece of information that says they like animals or pets. And so that would correlate with the information that we see in the FEC data as well. Now, what does a fundraiser do with that? Okay. You know, they probably have already received donations from these individuals. So they've already solicited most, if not all of the individuals who are in the database already, just from their ongoing work that they do, of course, to raise funds. So what does a fundraiser do with some of that information? It's interesting to them when they go out to make a call on an individual. They might have that information, but it's not going to necessarily be a solicitation based on that information at all. It's just one factor in many that fundraiser will have to use.
To use for what?
Well, to fundraise, of course. Yes. It is one piece of information. That's right. But you can't take that. If you took that information, we're not trying to sell a product. It says we're selling all the information about individuals who buy or who have made donations to the Humane Society, or we're not selling lists of anything to anyone outside of our immediate client, which is that university, based upon the information they have in their files. And again, we're not trying to find new individuals for them either.
Thank you. Commissioner, didn't want to interrupt if Commissioner Weintraub. Mr. Feely, I'd like, if you would please, to just go, if you could clarify a little bit in the request, you get to the specific purposes, and number two of that purpose is to verify or inform our wealth rating algorithm. And specifically, you say, we want to post the flag those that made meaningful political contributions. Could you help explain that for us a little bit?
Yes. So, yes, Commissioner, we receive a lot of information about wealth data. We have probably over 50 different wealth indicators that we receive from data vendors ourselves. And so information like this is very unreliable in many respects. Individuals who have wealth take great steps to try to make sure that individuals can't identify their wealth necessarily. On the other hand, we do look at all of these different indicators and try to correlate them and understand whether there are anomalies in the data or not. So we have suggested that if we do find individuals in our client's database who also have made, as we said, meaningful contributions to political causes or candidates, then that is one indicator that they have the wherewithal to make charitable contributions as well. And so again, it's simply an indicator that the individual may have wealth, but it's not verified in any way. And one of the questions is, what is meaningful? We set forth some numbers in there, but we haven't settled on those yet, because my guess is those numbers might actually go up a bit before, you know, we finish our analysis.
Thank you. So with the data that you collect, you would then flag it so that someone could then tell that someone has made meaningful contributions, and they may be, among other factors you mentioned, someone to reach out for contributions, for solicitation.
If they haven't already, but they probably already have already contacted those. And understand, I mean, in a large university, you know, they probably have a million records in their database. At any one time, they are probably only cultivating between 5 and 10,000 individuals out of that database on a direct personal basis. The rest is typically done through, unfortunately, these mass mailings that some of you obviously are receiving.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any further questions for the requester or the Office of General Counsel? Let me ask then, are there any motions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Cooksey.
I think it makes sense for me to go first. In Advisory Opinion 2021-01, I move approval of Draft B, which is Agenda Document Number 21-15-B.
Thank you, Commissioner Cooksey. Is there any discussion on this motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
Just to give everyone a preview, I intend to abstain on this vote and on the other draft. And I know that's unusual and easily misread, so with your indulgence, I'll give sort of a back of the envelope of what my thinking looks like. I went back and I read the statute, and I don't see any way of avoiding the conclusion that the requester is a person under the Act and that this is commercial activity, or used for commercial activity, which is, you know, the language of the statute. And I'm a little bit concerned because of the information at stake. You know, this is reviewed for everyone who works here, but, you know, our Act requires us to take private information, specifically public, you know, political giving by Americans, and make it public. And that's an exception to a baseline First Amendment rule that Americans have a right to privacy of association and belief. And our disclosure mission is narrow and has been blessed because it serves these narrow governmental interests in anti-corruption and informing the electorate. So as a policy matter, you know, I'm very sensitive to the fact that our carve-out is narrow and Congress's instructions are fairly clear. And I don't see how the use of that sensitive, constitutionally protected information by private parties for private gain serves any of the government interests that undergird what we do. And so I worry that, in addition to being contrary to Congress's instructions, we've taken as an institution a wrong turn when we started blessing this sort of thing. Now that said, I do recognize we have blessed it. And, you know, the Act allows groups to rely upon our advisory opinions. It immunizes them from legal consequences if they rely in good faith on what we put out. And that's one of the reasons, as everyone watching this knows, that we take very seriously what we put out through this process. I think everyone just got a good practical demonstration of that. And I can't, at the same time to what I just said, ignore the fact that there are organizations that have relied on good faith and with the support of the Act on our prior AOs, including AOs that are similar to what's being asked here. So I've struggled with this, and recognizing those reliance interests, I worry about clawing back what we've already done, but I'm also quite unwilling to go further. So, I mean, in saying all of this, I recognize that this is a tension that is in no way of the requester's making. I sincerely wish I'm a big believer in the AO process. I think it's one of the wiser decisions by Congress in setting up this agency. And I wish I could give the comfort of a clearer answer, but rather than further develop an area of the law that I think is mistaken, or undermine reliance interests that people quite reasonably have, at this point, I'm going to abstain, rather than push the law forward in one way or the other. So I plan to issue a more coherent and footnoted statement to that effect, but I wanted everyone to understand what I was doing.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I'm going to ask, there any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor of the motion presented by Commissioner Cooksey, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Please say no.
No.
Commissioner Walther, you're muted. I'm pretty clear it said no, but I don't want everyone to just take my word on it.
You're correct. I voted in.
Thank you. The motion fails with two voting in favor, Commissioner Cooksey and Commissioner Traynor, three voting against the motion, Commissioner Weintraub, Walther, and myself, and one abstention, the Vice Chair. Thank you. Any further motions? Commissioner Weintraub, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the requester has told us. I thought it was inherent in the written request and confirmed at the table that, in fact, they are their plan is to use the data from our database for solicitation purposes. And it doesn't have to be uniquely, this is the only information they're going to be using for solicitation purposes, but it does appear that they're using it for solicitation purposes. And I think that is banned under the sale or use provision. I see this as different from previous AOs that the commission has issued, because previous AOs relied on aggregate data. This does seem to be an approach that relies on identifying individual donors and subsequently reaching out to those individual donors who may indeed be in both databases, both the client's database and the agency's database, but still would be using that information as part of the fundraising effort. And so I think the answer is expressed in draft A. So with that, I will move approval of agenda document 21-15-A, which is draft A of a proposed advisory opinion in response to Illuminate 2021-01.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Is there a discussion on this motion? Seeing no interest, I'll call the question. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, please say no.
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 The motion fails with three voting in favor, Commissioner Weintraub, Walther, and myself, and two voting against the motion, Commissioner Cooksey and Commissioner Traynor, and one abstention with the Vice Chair. Thank you for the requester for being present, and I believe the Office of General Counsel will then send out a closeout letter in regards to this. Please correct me if I'm wrong, OGC.
I think that's correct.
Thank you. We're going to move on to the next items. Just to do a quick housekeeping, agenda item number 4, proposed final audit report on the Mississippi Republican Party, was resolved on tally. And we've held over agenda item number 3, the resubmission proposed modifications to program for requesting consideration of legal questions by the commission, LRA 1129, to a future open meeting. So now we will proceed to agenda item 2, which is audit division recommendation memorandum on Dr. Raul Ruiz for Congress A-19-03. And we have for audit, Mr. William Ants and Kendrick Smith in the audit division.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Commissioners. Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum, the ADRM, on Dr. Raul Ruiz for Congress, which was submitted to the Commission for consideration on January 8, 2021. The ADRM provides the audit staff's recommendation for each finding outlined in the draft final audit report. There are two findings. Finding one is a misstatement of financial activity. Finding two is a personal use of campaign funds. We are available to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, asking questions. I'm just trying to find my notes here real quick.
It's okay. Take your time, Commissioner Trainor.
We have two documents on this, right, that we're looking at, two agenda documents on this, an A and a B?
Is that to audit division, or are you asking me, Commissioner Trainor?
Yeah, I'm asking audit division, yeah.
There are two documents. There's the ADRM that was submitted, and then at request of the commission, we also submitted the committee's draft final audit report response.
Right. Can you walk me through what their response was and why it takes a different tack than what audit put forward?
Their response is summarized in there.
Yeah, they're not here to explain it. So I just kind of would like your take on their submission.
Okay. Well, as I said, we've put their response in the audit, in the draft final audit report.
I know. I'm having to log into VPN to find it real quick. So this is the problem with not having VPN up and running when you're online. So
I think in this environment, we have to choose connectivity or access. And so in this one,
right,
you chose connectivity. Would you like to take a recess so we can give some time for that?
If you could, that'd be great. That way I can.
That'd be fine.
I'm just trying to log in right now so I can pull up the document. So
I understand. We're going to. No rush on that. We'll take 15 minutes, I think, with the day, the morning we've had. Everybody can, as I said, we'll close meeting. Now you have time to get some water, maybe get a snack even. You've missed lunch, so let's take 15 minutes, please. We'll reconvene the meeting back at 2 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jim, I've started the feed. If you could go ahead and let me know when that's ready. Yes, it was a little slow on my end. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. We are live recording and you may reconvene the meeting when ready.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. We are reconvening the meeting now. At our last break, I believe, Mr. Trainor, you had some questions for the audit division. Would you like to proceed?
Yes, I hope I don't have an echo now that I have the VPN up, but if I do, y'all let me know. So questions for the audit division. In looking at the response, it's very clear from the memorandum that OGC put out that the log requirement that's in 113.1GA in the regulations extends from a 2002 rulemaking. And going back and looking at that rulemaking, 2001-3, we specifically said that that's what the rulemaking was based upon. And that rulemaking dealt specifically with a log requirement for campaign purchased vehicles. And here we're dealing with the purchase of gas and parking. So how are we taking and applying a rulemaking which specifically is based on one very narrow set of circumstances, which is the purchase of a vehicle, and applying it to a broad set of circumstances, that being the purchase of fuel and parking and other things of that nature? And what notice have we given to the regulated community that, that we're going to require this type of log requirement beyond what we said we were looking at in the rulemaking?
Madam Chair?
Of course, go ahead, Ms. Brown.
I believe we would defer to our colleagues in OGC on this question.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. The question of the log requirement specifically and an extension of the AOU cited is actually not what our analysis is, and we do not believe that that is what the auditors have done here. At issue in this audit are not campaign purchased vehicles. Instead, these are cars owned by committee staff, and the committee paid for expenses associated with the use of those vehicles for campaign purposes. Cite the 1995 explanation and justification, which expressly states that the personal use provisions apply to vehicles owned by any personally owned vehicle. I'm just looking for the exact language. The use applies to the use of campaign funds for expenses associated with any vehicle, regardless of whether it is owned or leased by the committee or the candidate. Because the expense is associated with a personal vehicle, which is at issue here, usually exists irrespective of the candidacy or the office holder duties, the use of campaign funds for these expenses will generally be considered personal use. And that is why we believe the committee is on notice that these expenses are in fact personal use, given that the committee has not shown that the activity associated with the vehicles was that the campaign paid were not of a de minimis nature, that the staff did not reimburse those expenses, or that there was no contemporaneous record provided. It's not specifically about a log requirement, but rather that a contemporaneous record would assist the auditors in confirming the information that the committee has asserted. And in the absence of either...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Madam Chair. So would not the report itself to the commission and a corresponding receipt and the description that the purchase of fuel or parking was for campaign purposes, would that not be a contemporaneous record?
It's not a record that the auditors can verify. The auditors can address this, but I don't believe that the committee provided any receipts or any other documentation, any vouchers or anything. I believe that there are,
but we, But we did have a statement from the campaign manager that they were. Now, I don't know if that was under oath or affidavit or how it was put forward. And we do have the report to the commission of the expense that's what the expense was for. And we have no reason to believe that they lied on their report, do we?
We don't have any reason to believe, but I think this goes to the auditor's ability to verify the information that is in the report. The regulations at 104.14A1, requires that committees maintain records which shall provide in sufficient detail the necessary information and data from which the filed reports and statements may be verified, explained, clarified, checked for accuracy and completeness. And the declaration from the campaign manager does not allow the auditors to verify the reported information.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Holloway, please.
I don't think it's really just a question of whether or not it was just a campaign expense. What we're trying to determine here is how to divide the expense. If a personal vehicle is being used, let's say I take my Acura out for a spin, but I'm actually on government time. So the question becomes, how much of that was government related and how much of that was Lorenzo Holloway related? That's really what we're trying to determine here. So it's not just about, is it a campaign expense? Did you purchase gas? Yeah, you can call it a campaign expense, but if I put $30 in my Acura, how does that split out between what I did for the campaign and what I did for Lorenzo Holloway personally? That's what we're talking about.
Well, and I think the opposite side of that same coin is how is Lorenzo Holloway harmed by the government's use of his Acura to go out and conduct government business, because you're putting mileage on your car and then you're going to turn around and be able to claim, obviously you would be able to claim that as a work expense of some sort on your taxes. But yet you're not necessarily going to have a personal log of what type of wear and tear you have on your vehicle. So there's got to be some give and take in the rules here I don't think it's the case where you have somebody who shows up for a job at a campaign with a vehicle. And then because I don't think the regulated community has been given any notice of this, that they need to write down the mileage the day that they start working for the campaign. And then they have to keep a personal log of all of the activities that they engage in a daily basis, whether it be driving around to put out yard signs, whether it be going to a press conference, whether it be going to a rally, whatever it may be. And they happen to put $20 or $25 worth of gas in their car. And I can't imagine a situation where the expense of gasoline, when we're talking about multi-million dollar campaigns, is not a de minimis expense in the overall cost of campaigning. I mean, having worked in campaigns before, looking at the expenses that you're making, I mean, look, the cost of the individual themselves and their salary is probably de minimis in consideration to the overall cost of the campaign. We spent $14.4 billion spent in the last election cycle. And here we're wanting to tag a campaign because they've got people putting $20, $30, and $40 worth of gas in their car without any type of notice from us, I believe. I mean, I believe that they're right, that we are applying a record-keeping logging rule that does not apply to the particular situation of gas and parking. And if they've made the statement under oath in their submission to us that that's what the expense was for, and we can't disprove that that's what the expense was for, then we have no reason to believe that the full $25 for gas didn't go to campaign activity. Does that make sense as far as the opposite side of what you explained?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. But also, I think we have to keep in mind that
is the way the system is set up is not about what the auditors can disprove. It's about what the committee can actually verify, what the auditors can verify with the committee's records. And that's what this is about, because the regulations specifically require, they file a report about an expense. They have to keep records so they can verify those reports. And if they filed a report saying that they had an X number expense for the campaign, then the auditors need to go out and verify that. So that's what this is actually about. And I'm not sure that, you know, I think a lot of requirements is pretty common. I mean, if I was running a business and I wanted a tax deduction and I'm going to claim a specific deduction based on travel expenses, I think the IRS may be interested in my records on that should I be audited. So I don't think this is anything new. This is not a new concept.
Well, let me ask you this. Then why do we not have a site to any MER or an audit or an advisory opinion or any other authority that would report to apply to the 18-year-old log requirements to gas purchases when we cite to 11 CFR 13.1 G8 in the log requirement applying to gas purchases?
Well, there could be a lot of reasons for that. One, it may be a situation where committees are actually just not using personal vehicles. It could be a situation where committees are using personal vehicles, but they're keeping a log. It could be a situation where committees are using a personal vehicle, not keeping a log, but they just haven't been audited. So there's actually a lot of explanation of why we haven't seen that.
No. My question was, is that in the memo, the October 19th memo that OGC prepared, we don't have any citations to anything internally where the commission has either dealt with in a MER or in an audit or in an advisory opinion or any other authority, statutory authority, whatever it might be, that would report to apply the log requirement to gas purchases.
No, what I was saying, that was my point, that, you know, it just may not have come up. You know, because of the various factual situations I just laid out, it just may have never come up.
Well, so for that means this is a case of first impression then for us, right? That we're taking the 18-year-old log requirement and we're now going to apply it to gas purchases. This is going to be the first time that the commission is going to undertake this stance that you must have a log for gas purchases and for parking and the other associated activities in the use of a personal vehicle that doesn't belong to the campaign or to the candidate. This is a matter of first impression for us, correct?
No, I don't think so. I don't think you can go to a situation where agency hasn't applied the law maybe recently in a long time and just conclude that that's an issue of first impression. That's just a case of it never arose. That doesn't mean that the law shouldn't apply. You know, it's just that it just hasn't come up.
And Madam Chair, if I may, and I believe, again, the notice to the regulated community is the ENJ, which discusses the use of a personal vehicle. So the committee has noticed that some sort of record is required when an individual using a personal vehicle gets reimbursed or the committee pays for the expenses associated with that vehicle. That has been in existence since 1995. And it may be somewhat along the lines of what Lorenzo was saying, is that other committees have taken this forward and that it hasn't arisen to this level within an audit. But there is notice to the regulated community.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Trenum.
Ms. Brown, if I could ask you, what would the committee have to produce in order to be able to justify these expenses as related to the campaign and not personal use? So if they had kept the receipt from the Exxon Mobil station that they purchased the gas from, would that be enough?
Madam Chair?
Please, Ms. Brown.
I would note that earlier in the audit process, this was actually a larger violation amount, and the committee was able to provide us with documentation sufficient to reduce the personal use violation. And so I would ask Mr. Antos if he would kind of walk us through or give us a couple of examples of what the committee provided to get us to where sure. we are today.
That'd be great.
Yeah, I'm just bringing up my spreadsheet here so I could give you some examples. As noted, the majority of these were expenses for gas at gas stations, and a lot of those there was just really no documentation that came with it.
Does that mean there's no receipt associated right. with it? So they paid cash for it with no receipt, so there's no bank record to show a transaction on a debit card or a credit card. I'm just trying to get at what type of information the committee could provide absent a log that would meet the requirements that we're trying to impose here.
Yeah, the ideal thing would be to have some type of a log or write some kind of mileage down that was the campaign expense portion. We've seen other committees when we've done similar reviews right, so where they printed out the Google Maps to show this is the distance from A to B.
Okay, so let me take that then. So let's say they put $25 worth of gas in their car. And they write down in the log that they've got 1,000 miles on the car, and then they drive 15 miles to help, put out yard signs for a particular candidate. And that's what they have. So at the end of it, they have, they've gone 1,015 miles after they put gas in it. Is that enough? Or do you also have to have a receipt to go with it to be able to know what the cost of the gas is so that you can then do the correlation of how many miles they drove versus how far they've gone? I mean, this level of record keeping for a staff person on a campaign is something new for me. And I've worked in a lot of campaigns and I've had a lot of people travel all over the place. So, Texas is a big state. And we have it's a pretty large congressional district. So what information we're about to impose this rule on the regulated community based upon this audit. I want to have a clear understanding of exactly what it is that they need to have in order to not face the same type of finding.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Smith, please go ahead.
Commissioner Trainor, I can tell you some of the other documentation that was provided by the committee for expenses okay. that we were also looking at. For instance, they provided the candidate's itinerary, which okay. would show like he had a political event in an area where he was, where there were lodging expenses. And so, and that was even jotted in his itinerary. Also, we've seen other solicitations where the candidate was doing some type of political activity, and it would show on the solicitation that the candidate was going to appear. So those are some of the different types of documentation we were providing.
And I appreciate that. Thank you for that. And I fully believe that with regard to the candidate and the personal use requirement, those types of things are very necessary. But here we're applying it to other personnel associated with the campaign, basically out in the scope of their duties as a campaign worker, keeping these type of logs. And we're wanting to know when they're on the clock and when they're on some type of frolic and detour from being on the clock and when they're off the clock. And I think that point's made very specifically by the respondents here when they talk about while it's not an issue in this case, but they talk very specifically about how if we were to carry this ruling forward, it's going to apply to rental cars being used specifically by presidential campaigns where you have people all over the country who are traveling for various functions associated with the campaign. So I want to know, I think this is a matter of first impression for the commission, and I want to make sure that I understand exactly where we're going if we're going to require campaign personnel to keep these type of logs. So they have to have a log of what the mileage was when they showed up. We've determined that. We need to know what the ending mileage was. They, I'm assuming we need to keep a receipt in order to put that in, to put that there. And that receipt has to match up with the amount that's reported to the commission.
Go ahead, Mr. Smith.
Commissioner Drain, I think if the committee would have maintained receipts, I think that is something we would have definitely considered. I don't know if it would have met the requirement, but we would have considered that. However, because they did not maintain any documentation at all, I think that was a problem for us.
Well, so why are we not tagging them for misreporting information to the commission? Because if they reported $25 of gas purchased at Exxon, and we believe that some of those funds were for personal use, which is what we're saying here in this audit, the $25 that was reported is incorrect on the report. It's not $25 that was spent. It should have been $15, and there should have been a reimbursement of $10, correct?
If I may, I think the personal use relates back to the E&J, which specifies when a personal vehicle is used. So while there may be an issue that the report regarding the reporting that they may not have reported the specific amount, the appropriate amount, it is still personal use because campaign funds were used for a personal vehicle. The committee has not shown that use was of a de minimis amount, that the owner of the vehicle did not reimburse the committee for that portion of their vehicle expenses that were associated with their personal use, or
right, so
it was not otherwise rebutted by a log or other record. Mm-hmm.
So that's my question. Why is audit not also finding that they misreported the expenditures for the gas in their report? Because they now have a reporting problem. One, they're missing a reimbursement. That should be an issue that comes up in the audit. And they've misreported the amount that the campaign actually spent. So the public's not informed as to the correct amount that's been spent. Again, if they've, I'm just take my example again. If they spent $25 on gas, they drove 15 miles. So let's say that's $10 worth of gas that they used for campaign related activities. They got the benefit of $15 worth of gas for personal use. There should have been a reimbursement of $15 from the campaign employee to the campaign, and the campaign should have reported an expenditure of $10 for the gas for the travel. Is that correct? And if
yes.
So, why is that not an issue? Why is that not showing up as an issue? Why are we only dealing with the personal use issue in the audit?
Yes, Mr. Ants.
Yeah, I'll try to explain that. Well, in your case where you're saying there was a $25 expenditure, maybe 15 was the personal part, we don't know that for sure. All we know is that there was a debit coming out of the bank for $25 that went to a certain gas station.
Actually, we don't know that because what I was just told is that we didn't have any evidence of that.
All we know is there were charges to these gas stations and there was nothing to support it. Why we didn't pursue that as record keeping, the record keeping threshold's a lot higher.
Okay. Okay. So, Madam Chair, just for the benefit of my fellow commissioners, at the appropriate time on making motions, I am going to move to approve the first finding and exclude the second finding. I think this is a case of first impression for the commission. I don't think that we have given appropriate notice to the regulated community of the requirement for the staff of the campaigns to keep these type of logs, and that if we want to do something like that going forward, we need to make sure that, we have some level of notice so that they can keep up with it. And frankly, it's one of those things that is so commonplace that it would require some sort of standardized form so that it would make it easy on us to be able to keep up with exactly how money is being spent. And again, you know, the cost of gas on a campaign that costs millions of dollars is by definition de minimis. And so for that reason, I'm going to make a motion to exclude when it gets time, but I'll let anybody else that has questions ask.
Thank you, Commissioner Traynor. Any further questions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the finding is well-founded. I think, you know, we've got, as counsel said, an E&J that goes back to 1995, and there's nothing particularly unusual about suggesting that receipts have to be kept if you want to be reimbursed for expenses that you incur, you know, in connection with your personal vehicle. Having said that, I also think the first finding, you know, as we have in previous audits recently, you know, we've got another finding that's headed misstatement of financial activity, where the bottom line is that we're saying they didn't misstate financial activity. There was no material misstatement. So I think at a minimum, we're going to want to amend that heading on that finding so that it is not misleading. I am a little bit, I am, you're muted.
You're absolutely right on that.
I'm a little bit confused when I read the narrative. Is it that during the course of the audit, they came up with additional records or made amendments that demonstrated that what we had originally thought were misstatements were not material misstatements, or was it that we just were wrong that it was misstated in the first place?
Please go ahead.
We had a misstatement, and the committee provided evidence that some of the checks that we were considering outstanding were actually voided. So removing them from our bank numbers brought them under the threshold.
So, again, I'm a little unclear. So it wasn't a it's not that they needed to amend their reports because they had misreported something. It's that we were reading something as a misstatement because we didn't know they had voided the checks. Is that what happened? I'm trying to figure out if there was ever a misstatement here.
There was a misstatement when we had the checks in our bank number, which made our bank number higher than the reported number to a material amount. But after we removed those, it came under and there's no longer a misstatement. But we didn't take that into consideration until after the interim audit report was out.
Were the checks voided during the audit process or before the audit process, but they provided you with the evidence that they had voided them during the course of the audit process? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yes, so they were voided, but we from the documentation we looked at, we saw a check register that they provided us that had the checks listed on there without any indication they were voided. So we
picked. Right, but when were the checks voided?
They were voided at the time they were written.
At the time they were written. So it wasn't a response to the audit. It was voided at the time it was written. So correct. Was there ever, so it doesn't sound like there actually ever was a misstatement.
Well, yeah, you could look at it that way, I guess. We were considering it a misstatement because we were considering them outstanding checks. Because they didn't provide us any further documentation to show that they were voided at the time. It wasn't until after we already picked them up as outstanding, then they sent us an email showing that one check was actually voided and reissued, and provided us the documentation for the reissued check.
I don't mean to interrupt it, but we have some very hurried hands up, so I'm going to ask if anyone else from audit would like to also join in. Mr. Smith, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Weintraub, we don't, when we reconcile the committee's bank activity, we always have questions. And so we go to the committee and ask the committee those questions and try to get those records to verify those final numbers we're unsure about. And so that's what we did in this process. We gave the committee several chances to provide this documentation or to provide an explanation to us, and they had not done that. And so that's why we went forward with the finding, and it wasn't until we had already gone forward with it that they came back, and then they said, well, we can give you further documentation now to demonstrate that these checks were actually void. But that's how it ended up as a finding, because no documentation had been provided to us to demonstrate otherwise.
I appreciate that we want people to provide us with all the documentation at the soonest possible moment, but I think the misstatement, the question is, was there a misstatement in the reports that they filed with the commission? Now, it sounds to me like what you're saying is you thought there was a misstatement because you didn't know originally that they had voided these checks, which they had voided at the time. I mean, it would be different if they had voided them later and then needed to amend. But it sounds like you're saying, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that they never actually did misstate this information on their reports to the commission because the checks had been voided all along.
Ms. Brown, would you like to jump in?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Weintraub, so I would just highlight that the committee does still have a misstatement. However, it's now immaterial based on the additional information that they've since provided to us. So the committee still does have a misstatement. It's just immaterial.
But if we had known at the outset that these checks were voided, they never would have had this finding, because we don't generally issue findings about information that we do not consider to be material.
Correct. But I'm sorry, Madam Chair. it's a bit of a timing issue, right? So if we don't have the information at the time that we're writing the report, we move forward with the writing of the report. And so if we receive information subsequent to that that would reduce the finding to make it immaterial, it's the finding is already in the report. We would just state that the committee has resolved it to the extent that it is no longer material.
And my point is, if I may, Madam Chair, that there's a difference between somebody who misreported something in the course of the audit. They realize that and they fix it. They amend their reports. And then it would make sense to me to say, well, they did misstate. There is a finding that they misstated something to a material degree that we recognize. Mm-hmm. But they fixed it. They corrected it. That's what we had with a couple of audits last time, where we had misstatement corrected. This doesn't sound like there was ever a material misstatement at all. We thought there were. I understand why you thought they were. I don't fault you for thinking that they were, because you didn't have all the information in hand. But in fact, it does not appear that there was ever a material misstatement on the reports they filed with the commission.
I think that we would agree with that conclusion. However, I guess we're faced with the issue of it's now already made its way into the report. And so our past precedent has been, once we're in that stage, that we just articulate that the finding is not material.
But But this is the point where the commission has to approve a report that says there's a finding. And I'm not sure I'm comfortable. You know, at first I thought maybe this is another one where we have to correct the heading so that it's clear that they fixed it. But now it appears to me that this, like I said, I'm not faulting you for it. I understand that you didn't have all the information and it looked like there was a misstatement, but we now know that there was not a misstatement. So I'm not sure that I, as a commissioner, feel comfortable voting to make a finding that they had a misstatement when they actually, a material misstatement, when they actually didn't.
So the, I'm sorry, Commissioner Traynor, I see your mic is off. I didn't want to interrupt.
Oh, no.
So the finding wouldn't be to, the finding would be that there is no material, misstatement. Let me also make this point, if I may, because it sounds like what would the alternative be? How would we otherwise articulate or not, this information within the audit report? And I raise that because even in the case where we have a finding where commissioners, where we don't have four approvals, the matter isn't removed from the report. It still remains in the report. It's just moved to the additional issues section. So even in that case, we don't remove findings.
I get that. But, I mean, it sounds like when we thought there was a misstatement, we were just wrong. And, you know, I don't know. I have a hard time as a commissioner approving a finding that, like I said, I had to read it a couple of times to try and figure out what was going on there myself. And until I came here and asked you these questions, I still wasn't 100% sure. And I think most people reading this report with this big headline that says misstatement of financial activity would assume that at least at some point, even if you read through and you say, oh, they corrected it, there's no longer a material misstatement. You know, I mean, I suppose we could have a finding that says, no material misstatement. That might be that's our finding, that there was no material misstatement, or we could in fact remove the finding. I have to say overall, just my overall reaction to this audit report is we need to, and those who've been around for a while know we've had these conversations before. We, I think, need to reassess our trigger thresholds for these audits, because we spent almost 2 years auditing this committee at substantial expense and devotion of resources both to the commission and to the committee. And at the end of the day, you know, this is after an election cycle where $14 billion were spent. And at the end of the day, after a 2-year audit process, we're arguing about $5,000 in missing gas receipts. And it just seems to me that if we are not doing random audits, which, you know, the commission no longer has authority to do, and if we did have random audit authority, we would probably get a lot more reports that had minimal or no findings. But if we are supposedly auditing committees for some sort of cause, you know, it seems to me if this is what we're ending up with, we need to adjust our trigger thresholds, because it does not appear to me that this one was really worth everything that we and they went through in order to come to these conclusions. But I mean, that's not for that. That is a sort of an invitation to my colleagues to that we all need to think about these things as we are looking at audit thresholds for the next cycle.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair, please.
Two questions coming out of, the colloquies both my colleagues, I think, quite persuasively have held. The first is with regard to the gas receipts and such. Can someone, and this is an honest question, how is it possible that we have a quarter century year old regulation and this is the first time this issue has come up, given that this seems like the sort of thing that would happen in literally every campaign over that period, or certainly the overwhelming majority of serious political contests? And whether we want to label that a question of first impression or it just doesn't come up before, like that, how? Honestly, like, just can someone explain that to me?
Madam Chair, if I may offer just a thought, it could be that in this particular audit, because it arose within the context of the personal use finding and a number of, I think all of the other personal use issues were resolved, this was what was remaining at the conclusion of all of the field work and, you know, post exit conference. Whereas perhaps in other contexts where there may be issues of gas expenses associated with personal use, it simply didn't rise to a certain dollar level, threshold level.
Okay, I appreciate that. I'll have to give this some thought, but I will say it makes me feel very uncomfortable that there may be moving parts somewhere in the system if this is just such a basic issue, has never come up before. Gives me a lot of pause. My second question is related to Commissioner Weintraub's questions, and maybe this is just taking up her invitation, but what do you guys down at audit need from us to feel comfortable taking a mistaken finding off the report? What needs to be done from your perspective for you to feel free to do that?
Go ahead, Ms. Brown.
Mr. Vice Chair, I think from our perspective, I'm getting disconnected from VPN. I hope you all can still hear me. Can you?
Yes, it's fine.
Okay. So from our perspective, we've presented a recommendation to the commission. And so in order for us to remove a finding from the report, it would of course take, four votes, from the commission. But I would just again, just reiterate that this would be, something different than what we've done previously, because we do have prior incidents where there were misstatements that were committee was able to provide documentation throughout the course of the audit after the misstatement was already presented in the audit report, where the commission concluded as a result of that there was no material misstatement. So at this point for us, we would just need direction from the commission.
I appreciate that. I'm asking a broader question.
Okay.
Discussions between lawyers and accountants are always especially broad because, you know, we both have our parallel sets of use of the English language. They don't always line up. I'm asking as a matter of practice. I understand what we can do in this particular matter, but it seems to me there's a difference between this thing came up and we need the commission to make a call on whether we're going to adopt this position versus, no, this is just an error. Like we held a view. We now know that view was wrong, you know, like moral certainty. The evidence has come out to affirmatively disprove this. And if you were another part of the agency, you would probably reconsider the recommendation. What's broken in the system where that's not an option, where you can't come to us and say, we don't need you to vote on this because we saw the checks. This isn't a thing. We want it out of the record. We don't want there to be this ambiguity in these questions.
I guess my initial response might be that we would have to come up perhaps with parameters. What defines at what point we remove something from an audit report that has already been approved to some extent, right? Because at this point, we've had an interim audit report. We've had a draft final audit report that both of which have gone to the committee, both of which have circulated to the commission in some fashion. And so we would just need, we would need a way to explain, one, to the public, right, when something is removed from the report, because ultimately all these reports will appear online in kind of chronological order. And so for it to be removed, we would just need, perhaps this is getting into Directive 70, which is already part and parcel to this particular committee, and modifications to it to describe at what point something like this might be able to be removed from an audit report.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Holloway, please.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. Directive 70 is the place to do something like that. And that is the directive that actually lays out the procedures in the audit report. So if you wanted a procedure where if something reached a certain level by the time that you got to the interim audit report or the final audit report, then you can just revise Directive 70. It could be done there.
And until we do that, you don't feel free to take those actions?
No, sir.
No, I it's sincere questions. I appreciate it.
Commissioner Trainor?
Ms. Brown, is what Commissioner Weintraub is discussing, if we would have considered an interim audit report in an executive session, would we have been able to remove it at that point and not have be dealing with it now in this audit report?
In the context of this particular Ruiz committee?
Yes.
No, because the information didn't come to us until after the interim audit report had already circulated and been provided to the committee.
Okay.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for audit or the Office of General Counsel? I was checking Commissioner Trainor because it looks like he's looking.
Oh, I'm good. I'm good.
Okay. All right. So are there any motions? Commissioner Weintraub? I apologize, Commissioner Trainor.
That's fine. I'll let her go first because I'm going to vote with her on that. Depending on what she does, I may make another motion.
Actually, no, you're probably not going to vote with me because of the way I'm going to frame this. But, you know, okay. I think it still logically perhaps makes more sense for me to go first. I'm going to move approval of finding 2 in the as described in the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on Dr. Raul Ruiz for Congress, A19-03. And the associated discussion in the draft final audit report.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Is there a discussion on this motion? Seeing no interest, I will call the question. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, please say no.
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 The motion fails with 3 voting in favor, Commissioner Weintraub, Walter, and myself, and 3 voting against, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Cooksey, and Commissioner Trainor.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Trainor, please.
My motion would be to not adopt the recommendations in the audit report for Dr. Raul Ruiz for Congress, A19-03. And just to clarify, not adopt 1 or 2 based upon Commissioner Weintraub's discussion of the problems with 1 and the issues that I see with issue 2 being a matter of first impression. So that's my motion.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Trainor. Is there a discussion on this motion? Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say I won't be able to support the motion, which conflicts with my previous motion. However, I do agree with you on finding 1.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. I also agree with you on finding 1. Happy to look further on Directive 70 to see how we can work on resolving this and making life easier for the audit division in the future so we don't have to be at this position. But I'm splitting. I'm half. So I just wanted to give you an indicator of that, Commissioner Trainor. So are there any further discussion on the motion? Then I will call the question. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, please say no.
No.
No. I have to apologize. I didn't hear, Commissioner Walter, if you voted on the aye
but,
earlier.
But I am the other.
Thank you very much. The motion passes then. With 4 voting in favor, Commissioner Trainor, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Cooksey, and Commissioner Walter, and 2 voting against the motion, Commissioner Weintraub and myself. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, thank you. And I'm committed to working with you all as well on Directive 70 so we don't have to face this issue again.
Thank you. That's going to, I believe that resolves all of our agenda items. So I am going to turn to, I believe it's a question that everybody on the screen has been looking forward to today. I want to thank everybody for their patience with working through everything today. I am looking for Ms. Orok, who is our acting staff director at this time. So I will turn to her and ask, Madam Acting Staff Director, are there any management or administrative matters that the commission needs to discuss today?
There are no such matters.
Thank you. The meeting stands adjourned.